All right, it's about that time, so let's go ahead and get started. We're down a couple of people, so that's okay. We're going to charge on ahead, record it, and it'll be available on the website as soon as I can upload a million things. All right, any announcements for the good of the cause? Any activities or stuff going on we should all know about? Yeah.
Haunted Hollow at Touch of Nature this Sunday.
Haunted Hollow at Touch of Nature.
Yeah, free event. Don't have to pay for anything. Come and have fun. Pretty Halloween-y, so dress up if you want.
All right. Haunted Hollow, Touch of Nature on Sunday. What time?
11 to 6.
So. All right, well, if we get anything like this weather, you're going to get mobbed, which is good.
That's true.
All right. Any other announcements for the good of the cause? There's a farm-to-fork dinner at the University Farms, $10. Tons of food, just good stuff, local. Saturday afternoon and, like, dinner time. If that's your thing, grab some tickets out in front of the Ag Building and so forth. All right. So, we are talking about, back out of this, we've been talking about kind of the human side of recreation management. Bless you. And we've talked so far about things like cognitive processes, like how do we think relative to our, how do we make decisions, how do we land at behaviors relative to what we believe, our attitudes about those beliefs, what we perceive about the site, about what's possible, and fourthly, our perceived behavioral control over those things. We've talked just a little bit about demographics prior to that, with things like, what's the age structure of folks visiting your park? Is it pretty much all like elderly tourists on their last big, you know, tour boat cruise? Is it a bunch of young families from a nearby urban area? Where are folks coming from? What are they like? What kind of general socioeconomic status range do you have among your visitors and so forth? And so today, finishing up on Monday, we were talking about trip characteristics. And we talked for a little while about group characteristics. What are the group dynamics? What are the status group dynamics, as researchers call it, of members among the group? Like, is there typically kind of a go hard or go home kind of a leader to the trip, pushing folks to go harder? Is it a fairly relaxed group that's based on, you know, consensus and sort of the minimum or the lowest common denominator activity and intensity, that sort of thing? Different groups need very different things out of you as a park manager, so just starting to get us to think about what range do we need to accomplish providing for different kinds of groups and so forth as a characteristic of the trip, not of the individual recreationist. All right, so other things for trip characteristics, obviously activity on site, which we started out the semester talking about. We also want to remember mode of transport is not the same as activity on site. So if you think about what's the developed campground at your park, maybe there are several. When was that built? So mode of transport changes and evolves and has different needs expressed by visitors based on how they're arriving, how they're getting around your park, as well as the activities that they're going to do. So mode of transport looks sometimes a lot like the activity, but it's more adjacent to that. So if somebody is arriving at your front gate for your park in a 50-foot RV, like a Greyhound bus-sized RV, that's not necessarily their activity. It's how they're getting around. Does that make sense? All right, so their lodging might be in a tent, it might be in an RV, it might be an actual lodge. Sometimes mode of transport kind of combines with those things. But somebody arriving with an RV is there to do activities like walking or day hiking or backpacking or fishing or ATVing or off-road vehicle use, etc. Okay, so we want to have a distinction between mode of transport and activity, because we're pretty good at thinking about activity and like what are the impacts of having a million people on a particular hiking trail, and how do we manage that? How do we cope with that? Do we harden the trail? Do we add extra trails elsewhere to split off some of those millions of people elsewhere, etc.? Lots of different strategies for that. But because mode of transport also evolves, remember that we want to, every couple of years, kind of take a look at how has mode of transport changed. So for example, RVs started out as, did anybody know what the first popular recreational vehicles were? They weren't even vehicles, they were trailers. But anybody know like an old school trailer, like brand, or what they look like? How big they were? All right, let's go with the original trailer first. Horse trailers started out as like wood slat, open platform, no roof kind of things. And you'd get horses up the ramp, drive them somewhere, unload them from your trailer, go riding, trailer and back to where you came from. These days, like we were talking about on Monday, horse trailers can have like flush toilet hookups. They're basically RVs fused with horse trailers. Satellite TV, air conditioning, like vanity lights around the mirror in the bathroom. I mean, pretty fancy, like shag carpet if you're into shag carpet, you know, whatever. But that trailer necessarily has to be heavier, so it's going to tear up soft surface roads like gravel roads quite a bit faster when those roads are wet versus an old school, basically repurposed hay trailer that you can load some horses on with some wood slats to keep them from launching off. Okay? Does that make sense? All right. Things are fancier now in some cases than they used to be. RVs are now the size of Greyhounds when the original RVs were like your Jeep. So if you think about the kind of physical campground facility that can accommodate 50, 100 in some of these big Forest Service campsites, campgrounds, 400 plus Greyhound size vehicles, you gotta have lots of electrical hookups and lots of sewage hookups and fresh water and like heavily paved improved surfaces to accomplish that in the first place, and specific layouts, because the turning radius on a bus is, actually, Jeeps have pretty terrible turning radii too. I'm just kidding. I don't like Jeeps. I do like Jeeps. Jeeps are fine. They're worthless and expensive. No, I like Jeeps. No, they're great. So you have to think about what happens when our campground is physically too small to get an RV out of. They're usually big enough that you can get them back in there, and then some of them get stuck because they're just too long. So as the state of the art, so to speak, for recreation mode of transport changes and grows, and because we live in a capitalist-dominated society, like physically gets bigger and more expensive and heavier and requires more electricity and things like Wi-Fi or people to throw up their hands and roll their eyes at you. Like we're park rangers. We're not in the business of providing Wi-Fi, but that's the world we live in now because a lot of people require that for their mode of transport. Yeah. So the other day we were talking about place attachment and place bonding and how that tends to bring people back to a specific site. And it becomes, for some visitors, a real point of pride and tradition to, you know, well, last year we shelled out for the big RV. This year, our big buy was the toy hauler trailer behind the RV. So our recreational vehicle can pull recreational vehicles. And we have Yo Dog. It's like, you know, you wanted a stereo in your stereo, so we put a exhibit, Pimp My Ride, right? So this is a thing, and it becomes a prestige thing among different status groups. Like, there's a Jeep, and then there are the low, wide, but lifted, squatty Jeeps with 16-ply knobby tires that you can't even run on a highway. And it's got the specific, like, vinyl bumper sticker that says, if you can read this, flip me over. And, like, the snorkel and the tire inflator that runs off the engine and all of this stuff. Like, it just, it keeps advancing and advancing and advancing until the collapse of Western civilization. But for now, at least, we've got a, if not making special accommodations for those, be aware that they're coming. So people are going to come to your park wanting to use their shiny toys and technology and so forth. And it gets bigger, and cell phones provide more on-site access all the time, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so that's another aspect of trip characteristics. How are they moving around on-site? Do you need to renovate your entire campground at the cost of $10,000 per parking spot on up from there to accommodate bigger vehicles because they're starting to come now and people are unhappy that you have no facilities for them? This land is your land. This land is also their land. So we have to come to grips with what are we going to accommodate? A lot of places, until they can sort of put together the operating funds to pave a big horse trailer unhitching area and so forth, they'll actually bar people from pulling their trailers into gravel lots because on wet days, those trailers sink in, they get stuck, and then you shred the lot trying to pull those trailers out. And that's an ongoing expense that you're not really asking for. You're trying to get some forestry and park management done, but you're in like perpetual repair it mode because people keep thrashing sort of underprepared, under-hardened recreation transport surfaces. Okay? We started talking a little bit about group characteristics on Monday. Things like, what's the group size? There's an exponential growth in wildlife impacts based on number of people in the group encountering the wildlife. Next, we want to talk about sort of springboarding off of group characteristics, specifically group size and so forth. We want to talk about the spatial distribution of use. So where are these groups going? And your temporal distribution of use. There are very characteristic patterns that happen in forest rec management because that Halloween trunk-or-treat activity based out of the RV campground that Rebecca was describing a second ago, that happens at a very specific time of year. And it has nothing to do with forest recreation per se. It has everything to do with the Catholic Church sort of taking over a pagan holiday in like Ireland and northern Germany and stuff like that, centered around Samhain. They make All Hallows Eve, and then Halloween is the following day, and you're a forester, but for whatever reason, we're dealing with trunk or treat, and toy haulers, and RVs, and all this stuff, right? So, we want to pay attention to what's the temporal, what's the spread out in time at a couple different scales. So, there's a daily time cycle in recreation use that shows up over and over and over. So, in your mind's eye, close your eyes for just a second, and don't fall asleep. Picture yourself as a newly arrived visitor to your group's national park. And you're set up in one of the campgrounds there, and it's the first full morning on site after your first night camping there. You had an okay night's sleep. Your body's still adjusting to sleeping on the ground. And I knew we should have gotten the 2-inch inflatable Therm-a-Rest, not these quarter-inch Z-Rest pads. This is BS. I'm calling my father. All right? So you're a little grumpy. But it is the first morning, and the weather's pretty good. It's like October 20th. It's gorgeous out. Where are you going to go? And what time of the day, what time on the clock are you going to arrive there to do that thing? All right, let's hear from you guys, gals. What did you picture based on your knowledge of your national park? Where are folks going on their first real morning on site. Yesterday was all setting up the campsite. Yesterday was traveling to and paying the entrance fee and all that stuff. That's all taken care of now. We're here to do the thing. Where are we going? What are we doing? When specifically, which hour of the day are we doing it? When are we starting? Okay. So what time on the clock during the day, which hour of the day, have you departed your campsite and you arrive to jump into the forest?
I'd say leave at 9.
Leave at 9.
And you get there by like 9:30, 9:45-ish.
Okay. 9:30, 9:45-ish. Anybody else from a different national park? What time of day are you starting your first real on-site activity? This is not a trick question. Presidio Canal National Historic Park. What time are people going out and historicaling? So you had some breakfast. Maybe you're staying in a nearby bed and breakfast. Okay, cool. And the older you get, the harder it is to sleep in. So you have a little bit of breakfast, like the overpriced muffin at the bed and breakfast. Get some, like, Subway sandwiches, throw in your day pack, and then you go visit the locks and dams or the historic boat reconstruction or whatever. At 8:45, you're on site doing the thing. 8:45? All right, we're going with it. What about at Roosevelt? What time are people getting up out of their, like, tourist campsite provider teepee or their tent or their RV with a toy hauler and a little tiki light stretched along, like, the fold-out porch? What time are they away from that, getting into either the prairie section or the forest section, doing whatever folks do at Roosevelt? Okay, so what time, sorry? Sun rises. That's high latitude up there. It's going to rise, well, it's October, so it'll rise a little bit later. Shorter day. All right, so we'll say 9:30. All right. So as it turns out, everybody else at your national park is running the same mental math. All right, if we want to go out and get our hike in or jump off into the forest or go check out the locks and dams, everybody's kind of getting started between 8:45 and 9:30, maybe 10 o'clock, if the drive is a little bit longer from like a lodge or campground to one of the more distant trailheads, for example. Okay? So, four activities, on-site activities, that require an alpine start, as it's called. Like if you want to go climb up the cables to Half Dome and enjoy your day there, you're not starting at 8:45, generally speaking. It's a long hike through the wilderness. You start when it's still dark, 3, 4 in the morning. And then you get there in time to join the line at the bottom of Half Dome and then climb on up, enjoy it, take a bunch of selfies, watch the rapidly onrushing electrical storm approach, and then scattering down the slope down to lower, less exposed country along with everybody else at the exact same moment. So we expect, because everybody's making the same mental calculations and doing either an alpine start for specialized activities, very specifically permitted activities, that sort of thing, or the much more common 8:30 to about 10 a.m. morning start, kind of a vacation soft rollout time, our trailheads, our parking lots, our everything is going to be real busy between 8:45 and about 10 a.m. It's going to drop a little bit as short activities, 2, 3, 4 hour activities, bring people off of those trail networks out for lunch back at the lodge. Does that make sense? All right, so We want to understand the within a single day temporal or time-based distribution of use. Peaks, kind of mid-morning, drops partway, not all the way back down, through lunch, and then back up for the afternoon, and then by about 4:35, definitely by about 6 o'clock, a lot of those trailheads are going to be real quiet. So, if we have a problem with an overcrowded place, its physical capacity is too small relative to the demand of people all trying to show up to the same place at the same time, we can use that typical time distribution of use to try and spread it out a little bit more as a ranger and heavily message people, hey, this place is absolutely, to quote Gwen Stefani, B-A-N-A-N-A-S, between about 8:45 and 10 o'clock. So if you want to have this trail to yourself, it's amazing. And we understand that and we like that energy. Get here anytime before 8:30. Be the first one out on the trail and you'll have it all to yourself. Or it'll feel like you have it all to yourself. You'll pass a bunch of people on your way out, but maybe you don't mind as much because you've already bagged that trail. You've already notched that one on your list of trails to hike. And you didn't have to deal with a bunch of crowds to do it. Okay? So, when we help visitors spread out within a single day at the same trailhead, we're purely manipulating the time distribution of use to give people a better experience and lower the pressure on our resources a little bit. When visitors are doing that for themselves in a negative way, that's called displacement. Okay? They're displacing to off-peak times. If you graph the busyness as a function of time throughout the day, we get that typical bimodal or two-peak graph. Mid-morning, mid-afternoon, real low before 6 a.m., real low after 6 p.m. in most places. And that's about it. Okay? Now, for very scenic areas where the view shed, the landscape, or the vista is kind of the value of that spot, like mountain peaks or vista sites or beaches very commonly have this. We're going to have a multimodal system where it's a little bit busy at dawn for the sunrise. It's busy in the morning, peaks or drops off a bit for lunch, busy in the afternoon again, drops off for dinner time, and then typically a much larger peak but smaller than the mid-morning, mid-afternoon peaks at sunset. Make sense? So, where the vista is the thing, like in some places around the Olympics when it's not cloudy, which is most of the time, we need to be aware of the time distribution of use being really pretty different than what we expect, and we need to take a extra close look at our facility and make sure it's good to go for people who are tired and they got started driving at 2 a.m. to get from their lodge up the mountain to this tiny little parking lot vista site, and it's dark, they're not awake yet, they're grumpy, they're not typically prepared for the temperature drop. So as you go up, things get colder. The top of Everest is a very cold place, etc. Top of Olympus Mons on Mars, very, very cold place. And so we got to ask ourselves, for these weird time distribution of use spots where sunrises and sunsets, but especially where sunrises are a thing, is our site built for that? Like, is it kind of idiot-proof? People aren't awake yet. It's too dark to see any of the signs saying, don't step on these fragile plants right here. This was a specific issue at the peak of Haleakala National Park's Haleakala Volcano, about 10,000 feet up. There's a tiny little structure visitor center. It's enclosed in glass. It's very, very windy up there. It's a tropical latitude park, but it's at 10,000 feet in that spot. So you typically have a cloud layer at about 5,000 feet, and it's real dark, and the stars are amazing. There's a huge astronomy observatory complex. There's a whole bunch of telescopes up on top of this mountain because it's real clear at 10,000 feet. There's no light pollution, or much less light pollution, around Hawaii than there is other places. this is a spot to go watch the sunrise and to watch it get lighter and lighter and lighter and then pop over those clouds right at 5,000 feet and they are blood red for about 30 seconds and the sun continues to rise about 15 degrees per hour and you go from red to salmon, it's not pink, and then like peach and then like onto white and then you know the sun's high in the sky and you're good to go. So there's a super duper endangered plant up on top of that mountain that grows up on top of that mountain and one other place on the face of the planet that I'm aware of called the Ahinahina. We talk about this briefly in 220, but here in 420 we get to kind of dig into the mechanics of it a little bit. So people start down in the lowlands. All the resorts in Hawaii around Maui, that particular island, are down at the beach. And a very, very small number of people will stay at hotels just outside of or any of the lodging available inside Haleakala National Park up on the slope. It's a multi-hour drive to get from the coast down in the city all the way up the numerous switchbacks climbing 10,000 feet. You're going slowly because they are almost 180 degree turns and there's dozens of them. You just can't go fast. Otherwise you go off the end of it, which happens very occasionally, mostly when folks are going down and they melt their brakes. It's very sad. Anyway, another story for another time. But this is a world-class sunrise opportunity. Like, this would be sick. Like, call the doctor, sick. Kind of a sunrise photo with your crappy cell phone, right? So, crappy cell phone camera lens. I'm not saying your cell phone is crappy. I'm not personally attacking anybody. But people get up there, and they've been driving for like 2-3 hours from their tropical Hawaiian resort. They're in their boxers and like sleeveless t-shirts, you know, we call them wife beaters, but that's not a PC term, but you said it, bro. Anyway, and they're stealing the blankets off of their hotel room bed because it's like 85 and humid down there on the coast, and it's literally below freezing up on top. And they're in like boxers or those really short shorts that girls wear, like Spanx or whatever they're called. Like, people are in their pajamas, you know, and they're freezing in this strong wind that's blowing across them at 10,000 feet and it's below zero. Like, this is hypothermia city done wrong. And the Park Service put a little structure up there that's enclosed. It's not heated, but you can at least get out of the wind and like huddle close to everybody in your group and like awkwardly close to everybody else in their group because they're all in their undies too, and it's just, it's weird. Like, it's super weird. They make it weird. Anyway, but we all get to see the sunrise. And then we go down the mountain. The problem is, a lot of people get the idea, oh man, it's gross and weird and it's like stranger danger in this little Park Service provided enclosed structure to get out of the wind. Let's go next to that. Because we can still use that as a windbreak. We're outside, but it's not a heated structure. It's not a lot warmer inside. It's just less wind. We can still use it on the outside. We'll just kind of spread out around it and trample all of the silver sword plants nearby. It's dark. It's like 4 a.m. The higher you go up a mountain, the earlier the sun rises because you can see it farther over the curvature of the planet. We do live on an oblate spheroid. It's not flat, right? So the higher you go, the earlier the sun physically appears over that curve. Does that make sense? Like, if you're 1,000 miles above a place, you can see the sun kind of continuously. The earth doesn't block. Anyway, all right, so we have a problem of a very specific time distribution of use leading to impacts on an endangered species, and that is no bueno according to federal law. So the Park Service has to cope with that very specific motivation to see specific conditions at a specific time. It's beautiful all day long, all night long up at that spot, but the sunrise, that's where it's at. That's what's kind of captured people's imaginations, and it really is that beautiful. So they have to deal with the size of the lot. What about everybody after the folks who are filling up all of the spots in that tiny little parking lot on top of a mountain? This is not a big flat place where we have a lot of space to spread out a lot of vehicles. We have vehicles pulling off on the side of the road. It is very steep in spots, right at the edge of the road. And remember, people have been driving for hours. They're not fully alert. We can get into some real bad situations in terms of visitor safety, as well as resource degradation and trampling endangered species here. So, what is the time distribution of use for any of your sites? On a daily scale, what is the time distribution of use? Is it the basic bimodal peak? Is it a trimodal peak with a smaller one at maybe dusk more commonly than dawn? More people are awake around sunset than sunrise, typically, in a recreation context. Is it a multimodal peak with 3, 4, 5 peaks at different times because specific things happen at specific times at that site, like Old Faithful? Every 90 minutes, the population at that spot spikes, and then it's blast off, and then it's pretty quiet for about the next 45 minutes most of the time. There are folks waiting from one eruption to the next, but not most folks. Like, they saw the thing, they're good, and they're gone. And most folks aren't going to try to get to the next eruption until right before the next eruption. So, what specific geothermal features, like a geyser, or an amazing sunrise, a topographic feature of the ability to put a road up to the top of a mountain with a little parking lot and a little observation area enclosed against the elements? Is any of your park's icon sites, do they draw use to them at very specific moments throughout the day? Okay. The only other way in which you want to think about within a single day time distribution of use is what interp services, what visitor communication, environmental education, site and history education, and interactive experiences do you provide? So amphitheaters are installed at pretty much all of the busy major national parks. Your national park probably has at least one amphitheater. Usually they're next to the visitor center, or more commonly next to the campground. And those are pretty darn quiet. They're basically empty, except for when you station a ranger there, or you are the ranger stationed there, to teach people about what are the bats flying overhead. Did you know there are bats flying overhead? Or what's the mining history of Mammoth Cave? How did Western people mine saltpeter out of Mammoth Cave in the early 1800s, for example, so we could start sort of gun-based warfare in the United States using domestic supplies instead of things from imported from other countries, so we could, you know, go fight and kill people in those other countries. And then, unfortunately, shortly after that, in the Civil War. Okay. And then other than that, those amphitheaters, not super busy. So when we go to Mammoth Cave here in a couple weekends, we're going to see, because a lot of the interesting underground stuff is specifically tied to specific times during the day, and then those times repeat across multiple days, we're going to get a very non-average distribution of use in time throughout the day. Super busy at the grand entrance, about every 20 minutes, and then pretty quiet. Maybe one or a couple of people just hanging around enjoying the vibe at the grand entrance of the cave system there when there's not a tour running through. And then all night long, basically nobody down there. It's super dark. There's no cell phone signal down there in the valley, so there's no point, right? Is life even worth living without 5G? Whatever. So, take a moment to think with your group. Is there any particular spot that lends itself to anything other than the default morning peak or the default afternoon peak? Okay. While you guys are thinking about that, at Cumberland Island National Seashore, there is one ferry on and off the island, and it's busy around the dock right at that moment. And then the rest of that entire wilderness island, super low use, super spread out, and you kind of go wherever you want, whenever you want. So there's just, aside from that dock, not really any peaks, which is kind of nice. But that's only because the Park Service strictly limits access to that island with that ferry. If you're not on that ferry, you're not on that island. For people whitewater rafting or kayaking in the Potomac River as a function of visiting Seminole Canal National Historic Park, there are specific times of day where it's appealing to put in. And it's pretty much kind of that 8:30 to 10 start if you're there for the day. And because you guys are an urban proximate park, there's a ton of people who are going there as locals to go kayak in their creek boat for a while or go play in any of the standing wave hydraulics. A lot of that happens starting right about dinner time. You get off work and you got your kayak loaded on top of your Subaru or Civic and get on down to the launch, play around for a couple hours till it's dark, and then head back home, take a shower. And hopefully scrub your body with lots of soap and disinfectant because the Potomac is nasty. At Isle Royale National Park, we don't have anybody from Isle Royale here today, but they have an amphitheater on Isle Royale and right next to the lodge and the little sort of ranger station right there. The entire rest of that island is wilderness. But the wilderness trail system there connects people to cabins. Or not cabins, open front shelters with just bug netting across the front of them. And the bugs at Isle Royale can be heinous. Emphasis on heinous. So the use peaks there for each of those shelters tends to be a characteristic amount of time between... it's based on the trail distance between each shelter. So when you're backpacking there, you're basically going from shelter to shelter, throwing your stuff in, and at sunrise and sunset when the bugs are out of control, everybody's in those shelters if you're in the backcountry or in a tent. And other than that, it's peak and drop with the ferry bringing people back and forth from mainland Michigan to Isle Royale. And walking the 100 yards or so to the little lodge there or to the little amphitheater there when they have ranger talks there. And that's it. So there's a very tight time effect of that ferry. There's a very tight time effect of those bugs pushing everybody out of the backcountry and into the little backcountry shelters where they can get away from the bugs for that ridiculous hour at sunrise and sunset when they're just insane. So think about any spots at your park that might lead to a specific, potentially problematic, in terms of trampling wildlife, vegetation, whatever. Any kind of issue based on the kind of site, the kind of activities that people are doing.
I mean, even to get to ours, it doesn't have an airport. So, like, you're getting a ferry to even get to the island of St. John, which is 31 way, 50 round trip. So, like, that could limit some people. They do have them going every 2 hours, but, you know, it just depends. So then you're going to have that 2 hour. When the ferry comes, you've also had people talking about the beaches, and then they're the only one until a cruise ship also comes there. So you've got the ferry coming in, the cruise ship's coming in.
Yeah, so for the recordings here, Rebecca's describing for the island of St. John or U.S. Virgin Islands. It's pretty tightly tied to a ferry arriving every 2 hours. And a lot of these parks where folks are, they're tied to an access control like a ferry, Isle Royale, St. John, places like that. Outside of those ferry moments, you're pretty much, you don't have to plan on much happening in terms of like big clots of people, like too many people in one place at one time kind of a deal. So once you address the peak, like that boat can only carry so many people, once you've got that situation addressed, you're kind of good by default for everything else in terms of overloading, overcrowding. Which is a really nice thing. A lot of these parks have fairly limited access, right? When we're looking at the kind of the transportation facilities layer of resources, you know, where are your roads, where are your trails taking people, all of that stuff is dependent on the maximum busyness conditions of the ferry or the cruise ships, if that's a thing, or whatever. Okay, so let's fast forward, or not really fast forward, zoom out from a single day's time cycle. Let's consider about a week, week and a half long time cycle. Now, is your park, this is a slightly less direct question than, do you have sites that bring people at very specific times of day? Do you have a park in general that your visitors, it seems like they generally look at it as, this is a day trip park? Or is it like a weekend trip park? It's good for 2-3 days, maybe a long weekend, and then we've kind of seen everything and we're on to the next thing. Or is it a week to week plus park? Like, this is the kind of place where people maybe fly in because it's a little bit more remote and there's so much to do, it's so outstanding and unique and beautiful and all of that, that you'd feel really shortchanged if you were just there for a day trip. Like, you couldn't even catch all the famous, prominent, easy-to-access stuff. There's just too much of it, maybe too spread out. So is your park a day trip? Is it a weekend trip? Or is it a week-to-week-plus kind of a trip park? Great Smoky Mountains National Park is a week park. People tend to arrive there and stay there for 4 to 6 or 7 days, sometimes longer. You can be there for up to a couple of weeks at a time. In terms of like the maximum limit on reserving a campsite, for example, and having a place to land. But you don't necessarily generally go to Great Smokies as like a 2-hour nibble and then call it good. You're there generally for at least a couple of nights. Isle Royale National Park, by virtue of the fact of being locked behind a 6-hour ferry ride, is typically a week park or a 2-week park. You're going there because you are going there and you're staying there. Sino Canal National Historic Park, you might get kind of two patterns there. People who are cycling the whole thing or ultra running the whole thing, spending a week or more. Otherwise, maybe a couple hours at a time. Maybe a day trip. Okay? So, for any of the others, like Roosevelt or, you know, wherever. Are you a day trip park? You a weekend park? You a week park? Okay. All right. So maybe you, on your big road trip out west to the northern tier, you hit up the forested section for 3 days, do some stuff there, check out the other section for another 3 days, and together, plus driving, that's about a week. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Anybody else?
What's the Olympics like? It could be all of that, really. Like, you have the people that go hardcore, you can stay out there for an entire week pretty well and fine.
Yeah.
But then you also have, like, the mom and pa's that come in with their kids for the day trips, the weekend trips. You know, so you can go anyway at Olympics.
Right on. So that's the non-trivial answer. That is, the closer a park is to large population centers, the more we're going to have to expect to accommodate the 2-hour in-and-out quick day trippers. They need certain things. They need clear signaling and wayfinding. How do I get to where I'm going? Because I got 3 hours. And then for a park like Olympic, where you also have folks arriving for a week because there's legitimately that much to do, we're going to need bigger trail networks. We're going to need more backcountry campsites. We're going to need more areas that are sort of well set up and managed and run for hunting and fishing and stuff like that, because people are there to be there for a while. Mammoth Cave is which kind of a park in terms of the week time scale, temporal distribution of use? Anybody's guess. I know most of you haven't been there yet, which is why we're going, but anybody hazard a guess? You there for a couple hours, a couple of days, typically a week or more? They could, yeah. When you take a look at the data, you generally get a sense of it's people kind of splitting the difference. So there, normally, aside from COVID, there are lots of different cave tours and stuff like that. Each of those is typically a couple of hours long, up to the wild cave tour, which is 6 or 8 hours long. And it's cool. The sense there is that, gosh, we can do a couple of different cave tours, see different kinds, different parts of the cave. There's some hiking and biking trails and stuff like that, but I'd be hard-pressed, even as somebody who knows Mammoth Cave pretty well, I've been there a bunch of times, I'd be hard-pressed to put together an engaging 2-week-long trip. Like, I don't think I could come up with 14 days worth of blow-your-mind amazing stuff to do. But that's okay. We talked about how the size of a park like Olympic, you know, it's big. It's relatively large, just some big population centers. Mammoth Cave is kind of not super huge. It's like 6 miles on a side. Not very big. Now, the cave system is enormous. It's 400 plus miles of caves mapped out of that 6 mile patch and extending out well past it in a couple of directions. But there's a couple of small towns nearby, and they've got some kind of touristy fun stuff to do, some commercial, like privately owned cave tours and stuff like that as well. But it's, you know, it's good for a couple of days. So a lot of folks will drive from a place like St. Louis or Chicago to Mammoth Cave, spend a long weekend there, and then generally be satisfied with that and head on home. So that's the level of amenity that Mammoth Cave staff need to be ready for and plan to. Occasionally we'll get somebody, usually retirees, that are there for 2 weeks straight. And we have some additional sort of, you got to look a little bit harder for extra things to do, things available for them. But by and large, there's not a huge, like, overwhelming press of people there for 2 weeks straight. So they don't manage the park like that. And we see that in the infrastructure and the activities available and all that. All right, cool. So that's kind of the daily scale, the weekly scale. Now let's zoom it out to the yearly scale. Based on your latitude is a huge determinant of this. When is peak season at your park? Is this a summer park? Stuff in the southern Midwest, like the Shawnee National Forest, which is not a national park, but it has a bunch of recreation use. Over 90% of people going to the Shawnee National Forest, over 95%, I think, are there for recreation purposes. So we got to pay attention to this, even in a national forest. People don't hit Shawnee super hard in the middle of summer because it's hot and the ticks are really thirsty. And here in about a week or so, when the leaves are really popping color-wise, the Shawnee blows up with so-called leaf peepers. The entire tourism industry of the state of Vermont and of New Hampshire is built around leaf peepers because they got a lot of forests up there. And so in autumn, if you want to go see the, like, world-class fall foliage scenery here in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, the Green Mountains of Vermont, you gotta rent your bed and breakfast rooms out like a couple of years in advance, no joke. Like, the demand is that high for that specific window of time. And you're never quite sure if you're gonna hit it, but people are willing to plunk down, you know, hundreds to a couple of thousands of dollars to have their shot at getting those bed and breakfast rooms, those hotel rooms, and so forth. Okay? The White Mountains and the Green Mountains also have a bunch of ski slopes attached to them. So there's a big fall spike during mud season, leaf peepers, and then there's a big, but not quite as high, wintertime spike for folks going to areas that serve ski areas. So what is your park on the yearly time scale? It used to be that we talked about what's the peak season at a park, but that's kind of a naive guess. then we started talking about shoulder seasons, where people who were crowded and pissed off about the crowds would go on either side of the peak season. And then we have like the off season at a lot of parks, where seasonal rangers rotate off of a 1039, a 6-month tour duty at a particular park that goes somewhere else that has a peak season during this park's off season, and sort of bounce back and forth between those two for a couple years, and then they qualify for permanent full-time status at whatever park they would like to work at, which is how that goes. We'll talk more about federal stuff, employment stuff, for the third half of class today. All right, so what is your park? When is its peak season on the annual time distribution of use graph? You have a peak in January? The Shawnee does not really peak in January. You have a peak in kind of late spring and early to mid-fall. A bimodal annual distribution, like the Shawnee National Forest. Is it summertime and summertime only? Denali National Park has not a ton of visitors. Most of those are in the short 3-month-long spring, summer, and autumn seasons of what the rest of us would call just the middle of summer. And then there's a little bit of wintertime use, but it's so small that you're talking about a pretty specialized, small, elite crowd, dog sledding and stuff like that anyway. What's your park's annual season? When is the peak? Or is it even just one peak? Or is it two? Or maybe multiple? Anybody? When is it really nice? When's the nice time of year at your park? You don't go to Canyonlands National Park in August. You don't go to Great Sand Dunes Park and Preserve and get out on the dunes in August. You will literally cook yourself alive. Yes.
Reach 100 degrees in midday.
Got it.
And so that's when a lot of hikers go out there to
explore. All right. So for Zion National Park, if you have a graph running from January to December, it's going to be pretty low-ish in December, but not, or in January, but not dead. Like, you can always throw on a jacket or another layer if you're going to any of these hot parks in the winter. And then around April starts picking up spring breakers and then summer vacation folks and so forth. But it's hot in August. It's like miserable hot, you know, but it's a dry heat, so it's fine. It's fine. We should have got our reservations earlier, honey. We could have been here in October. So we've got a long, flat shoulder season through the summer, and then peak season, September, October, maybe into November a little bit, and then down into the off season, where most folks are a little bit less attracted by potentially camping in snow. I think snow camping's nice, but whatever. So it's not necessarily a single peak. It's like a sort of a Quasimodo, like a flat part and then a hump for Zion National Park. For Isle Royale, you're kind of crazy if you're going even on a former Coast Guard cutter operated by the National Park Service as the ferry. I would not want to be on Lake Superior in the winter whatsoever. You could not pay me to do it. Like, there's a lot of shipwrecks in Lake Superior. And once we get past, like, the spring storms, I'm down. It's a gorgeous place. It's a long trek to get there, but once I'm there, I'm there, right? That's a week-plus kind of a park. Grand Canyon, super nice in the spring and the autumn. Literally lethally hot in the middle of summer at certain times. Okay. Acadia National Park is, like Great Smokies, very close to like a couple of 100 million people, mostly United States Americans. But it's so far north, it's high enough latitude, it's a little bit like Roosevelt, that it's just a real long winter. Like, they should have, if it were further south, like a March through October, maybe into November season. But you can get snow there in like May. And so most people don't even really think about it. They don't even start operating the shuttle buses until Memorial Day weekend, the end of May. And they stop running the shuttle buses, I think, around Labor Day weekend in September, because it's starting to get cold and gray in the northeastern, touching the Atlantic part of the coast. All right? Cool. So, that's the time distribution to use at three different scales for your park and parks generally. And there are meaningful and real differences based on that. The narrower your window is in a year, the more it crowds everybody into those few months. So Acadia gets very intensive use on a small island in a fairly short window of Memorial Day to Labor Day, and that's it. And the rest of the year, like the other about 8.5 months of the year, yeah, there's still some visitors, but you can get a lot of park management done because you don't have to like work around huge crowds all the time. Okay, so the cycle of things, the feel at any particular park has a lot to do with what's the annual cycle like there. Are you constantly dancing around visitors? Is it a year-round park? Or not so much? The National Mall, being at mid-latitudes, right next to Sino Canal National Historic Park, millions of people living nearby, and so forth, has a huge season and huge visitation. Lots and lots of millions of people. But it's also, it's an hours park. It's not a two-week park. There's no campground at the National Mall, right? So you're there to, like, play Frisbee or do that whole, like, recreate that whole Captain America and what's the guy with the wings jogging, and the Captain America guy keeps lapping him, and he's like, oh, not again, man. And then, you know, it's like a bro fist moment. Like, you're there for that kind of thing for a couple hours at a time, and then maybe go to one of the Smithsonian's on a different day, or the International Spy Museum, which is pretty sweet, or whatever, around the National Mall. So it's a bunch of people for most of the months of the year, and then they're actually only there for brief little nibbles or hops to visit the Vietnam Memorial or the Lincoln Memorial or whatever, not to be there for a couple of weeks. All right, so time distribution of use. Spatial distribution of use is tightly coupled to time distribution of use and very much to the named and improved, meaning park facilities built around it, sites at your park. So, I'm not going to belabor the spatial distribution of use, except to explicitly connect it to what are those time patterns at the daily, weekly, and annual scales, and you'll have a really pretty good idea at that point of where you're going to have problems with too many visitors in a spot, or where you are potentially underutilizing a lot of your park and allowing crowds to happen by not having enough people in certain places that can handle that use. So the Bureau of Land Management, which does not run national parks, but they run a lot of areas wrapped around Western national parks, unimproved areas, wildlands, we'd call it the open range before it was all barbed off. They have lots and lots and lots, like many tens of thousands of square miles of open bedrock land, where there's just not even any soil. And you can put a lot of people out on that, doing a lot of different recreation stuff, kind of all year round. It's kind of hot and dry and exposed, or very cold and dry and exposed. But if you want to think about it in terms of like park management, managing those BLM recreation areas, they're kind of underutilizing a lot of that space because everybody wants to be next door at Canyonlands, very intensively using a very small but complex canyon system where you can fit a lot of people in and they won't see each other because they're all in the guts of the canyon and so forth. So where you have big areas that are getting underutilized in terms of spatial distribution of use, not enough people are thinking about using that spot. If you got another area that's super busy, well, let's see if we can meaningfully increase supply of your recreation resources by improving access to the areas that are not getting as much use as they could handle just fine. Okay. So, do you have any areas on your map that are potentially pretty underutilized? They're resistant to recreation impacts, they're resilient from recreation impacts, but you just don't have a lot of points of interest right there. Think about your park. All right, moving on. We're going to switch gears here from talking about trip characteristics, including time and location of use. We're going to switch now into, as we discussed and agreed at the beginning of our semester, we're going to talk a little bit about doing resume stuff. So, hard left turn, but it's better than being hard right J from Letterkenny. All right, here we go. It's about 3 o'clock. We're about halfway through the class. Let's take a couple minute break, stretch your legs, and we'll switch gears completely from talking about your park to getting together your federal resume and how completely different that is from all the other resumes you've ever written. And we'll demystify that, make it a little bit less complex. We'll chunk it down into easy, non-intimidating tasks. And this will be our outdoor lab for today. So come on back in a couple of minutes. We'll get started again. Of you not stretching your legs, this is what failed spatial distribution management looks like. It's Horseshoe Bend, and there are just piles of people right next to about 1,000-foot cliff. It was taken a couple years ago on summer camp. Just crawling. Went from a couple of hundred visitors to a couple of million visitors over the course of about 5 years, thanks to social media. They're now putting in fences and stuff like that.
That's a horseshoe.
Horseshoe at sunset. Sunset view. So, temporal distribution of use tightly chained to spatial distribution of use. The number of recreations per square mile is near zero everywhere around that, and then right there can be thousands per square mile, like in that one square mile. It's wild. Or it's not wild anymore, it's super trampled and dead. Monday, just for you guys. Nicely updated from the previous edition. There are some. I was just looking at them with Danielle the other day. I'll pull up.
I'll look too, but I'm like, what are you looking for? I was looking up seasonal pathways.
I did not see any pathways when I checked. I think it was last Wednesday before class. Yeah, but the...
just to see what they look like.
Yeah, the pathways one in particular might only be up for a couple of days at a time, so...
are just finishing their first seasonal, like, okay, now what do we do? Find some other seasonal job. Death Valley or something. Hmm. I've never seen backcountry ranger jobs again.
So we'll talk about how this
search
works.
Search or what to look for, that would be awesome.
Yeah. All right. All right. How are you now? Good. You not so bad. Let's get started again. Let's talk about federal forestry, in specific recreation management jobs, and how to get them. As advertised previously in the semester, the one book that you need to get your grubby hands on, whether it's a new or used copy, these are available online for like $3 used. It's 16 new, like it's not going to kill you. This is the one. This is it. The Federal Resume Guidebook, 7th edition, came out in January 2021. It's by Catherine Troutman and Company. This brings us from a fraction of a percent success rate to, if you want to think of choosing from among multiple jobs, as over a 100% success rate. It gets us right there, in my personal experience with many students in the past. So this is the one. 6th edition is pretty good as well. 7th is even better. They just keep adding small, short sections. It's a very applied book. It's non-technical. You're not going to get stressed out reading this thing or whatever. So... the first thing we want to do is talk about what your target is. So you don't want to use the USA Jobs search engine for a specific job title, because there's a huge amount of bureaucracy in getting anybody hired with the federal government. They don't want to have to specifically and separately name a bunch of different, meaningfully different job titles, because each of those has to be like approved and vetted, and just like there's a ton of extra just mindless work to get those listed. So what instead we see is you'll have 20 or 30 different like job tracks under one position title. So, Rebecca was asking during the break, I haven't found anything for backcountry rangering yet, which seems like a pretty good job. And if these national parks actually staff the game that they talk, we're going to need some backcountry rangers. How come I can't find any backcountry ranger job titles? Well, because it doesn't exist. If you search the word backcountry on USA Jobs, you'll get the following job titles. Student trainee park ranger. I bet that some of you might consider yourselves students. So, that's an all aboard the Clue Train kind of call to seek out anything that has a student-oriented or recent graduate listed attribute to it. All right, so student trainee park ranger, starting at 43,683 GS7, and then it goes up from there. Temporary to full-time. National Park Service, Department of the Interior, West Glacier, Montana, Glacier National Park. That's how you get in, okay? But it doesn't say backcountry ranger. It says student trainee park ranger. And the bigger listing is going to be under a couple of different things. So, biological science technician has the keyword backcountry in it. Okay? So you could be doing ranger stuff, wearing a ranger uniform for years and never formally, technically be called a park ranger. Does that make sense? All right. So if we talk a lot about park rangers in this class and you get a little bit discouraged when you search for park ranger and not much comes up, that you're feeling competitive for or interested in like job location wise, don't worry. Search for the skills on USA Jobs that you like to use. Search for the settings in which you like to use them, like backcountry. Okay? And don't pay any attention at all to the title of the job, because again, 20 or 30 different job types might be listed under biological science technician. They're a little bit vague on purpose so that they can just kind of recook the same listing each year, even though like the on-the-ground management projects change a little bit each year. Like maybe we need to hire a couple more trail crew folks versus wildland fire folks, but we're hiring both of those under the biological science technician authority because wildland fire management has everything to do with forest biology and so on and so forth, right? So a lot of these jobs, especially later on, will start to roll more areas of responsibility, more skill sets in together under the same listing. And so you'll see a bunch of these different job types listed under a single thing. Also, for backcountry, we get park ranger protection. Department of the Interior, multiple locations. Starting GS 5 to 7. So that's starting at $20.84 per hour at the lowest possible end. You guys are probably at GS 5 or 6, maybe 7, as undergraduates, depending on your qualifications so far. We'll talk about what those are. Not to exceed 1,039 hours. So this is called a 1039 colloquially. That is 1 hour less than 6 months of full-time work. This is a seasonal temporary position. And before you can sail right into a permanent full-time position and be like the head ranger at such and such national park, you got to do a couple of years of seasonal one, seasonal two, maybe seasonal three is back doing the same thing the next year as seasonal one. So 6 months here, 6 months there, 6 months back, or 6 months in a third place, 6 months in a fourth. And then eventually you've checked the boxes for whatever the full-time permanent requirements are for that line of work. All right, so park ranger protection, National Park Service, Department of the Interior, multiple locations. This is open for about 1 week. And this represents... Oh, interesting. All right. Lowell National Historic Park. like CNO Canal National Historic Park, but in Massachusetts. Assateague Island in or near Berlin, Maryland. Cape Cod National Seashore, right outside of Boston. Franklin D. Roosevelt National Historic Site. Faked you out. It's in New York, not the Dakotas. All right. So, there is... this listing is for 24 different locations, including those four. This one listing. So if you don't see a huge, long list, like a pages-long list of different things based on one of your search terms, you got to click into any one of those listings and see how many things these actually represent, right? So this says, this job will close when we have received 480 applications or the closing date hits about a week after this is listed, on the 24th in this case, so like early next week, Sunday. So in 24 locations, each of those gets 480 applications, right? So each listing is a bunch of different spots. It's a bunch of different opportunities. Don't lose heart if you see like one or a couple of listings. These things are only even visible for a week at a time in this case. And some of the pathways ones that are specifically designed for you as current students or just about to graduate students, by the time you'd be doing it, those are listed for as short as like 2 or 3 days at a time. So you want to make a habit of sort of like exposure therapy of, you know, getting past the stress of looking for a job by checking early and often, repeatedly, a couple of times a week, if that's what it takes. All right? So, this is the kind that we might be looking for. Temporary, not to exceed 1,039 hours. So you open up any of these individual listings. It'll start with the summary of duties and so forth. So a park, a protection ranger applies laws and regulations to protect visitors and resources of our parks and ensure a safe visitor experience through patrols, emergency response, and investigations. Exactly what we think of a lot of park rangers doing. This is an LEO position, law enforcement officer type position. Okay, so gun on your hip, maybe a shotgun on the rack in the back of your truck, bulletproof vest, that sort of thing, and helping out with search and rescue when that comes up. This particular ranger listing might not be interesting to you, but it's a good proxy for other kinds of ranger listings. And remember, even though you're probably not going to be camping for 2 months straight, like a wilderness ranger will be, backcountry is listed in this. You're going to be spending some time, like, out in nature at some of these parks. Some of them are pretty small and urban proximate, like some of the seashores are pretty thin little strips next to the cities. But some of them you get way back in there, okay? So, responsibilities. So these would be, like, some of the skill sets. Enforce laws, patrol front country and back country sites, emergency response using the ICS, Incident Command System, medical services, search and rescue, wildland and structural fire suppression, visitor stewardship and orientation. It's not all writing tickets to protect Smokey the Bear. It's also just like talking with visitors. Hey, what brought you here today, you know? Visitor facing stuff is super important. You don't want to come across like just a hard-ass enforcement-oriented police officer, you know? You can just be a police officer for a town or city if that's your jam. But for rangers, you know, we want to be a little bit friendlier than that. Let's see, boundary enforcement, protection of natural and cultural resources, wildlife, plants, arc sites, historic buildings, assist with preliminary investigations of felonies, crimes and violations of park rules, public use, safety requirements, and motor vehicle accidents, crowd control, proactively protect park resources from all forms of degradation. You are the tip of the spear in this particular job listing. And it's a GS 5 to 7, suitable for current and recent graduate students. It's a 1039 seasonal. This is how you get your foot in the door, if this kind of a thing is what you're going for. So, if this is not the kind of thing that you're going for, you're looking for some of the same characteristics, just a different list of job responsibilities. Still 1039s, still GS 4, 5, 6, 7 range. Let's see, and so forth. Supervisory status, no. You don't have to lead a team. If you're an introverted forester like me and you really hate talking to people for long periods of the day, it's exhausting, you're looking for a supervisory status no position. And 1039s are generally more like that, okay? And then it'll give you a detailed list of conditions of employment. So things like, you gotta be a U.S. citizen to work for the federal government as a direct employee in this particular case. They're gonna do a background check on you because you're doing law enforcement type stuff. They wanna make sure you're not the next Ted Bundy. And so on and so forth. Government housing may be available. For some of these positions, occupancy of government quarters may be required. So that's just a little detail in the conditions of employment, but that's a big detail. Like, for some of these places, you have to live at the duty station because that's the only lodging present in some of these bigger parks. Make sense? There's like headquarters and then ranger station X, Y, and Z, and you might be the one person living at that ranger station for 6 months straight and, you know, helping out folks in that particular area. So it's good to know what those requirements are. The qualifications section of the page, this is a hard list. Like, this is not stuff you can kind of squeeze by on some of them. They will specifically use this list to include you in the, we're gonna look at your application and see what your specific experience and accrued skills are and so forth, or we're not. Like, if you can't say yes explicitly to all of these, last year you had to like check the box for each one of these and certify, yes, I can meet this, then you just can't apply to this position. Most of them are fine, right? You gotta be 21 years of age or older. You're gonna be handling a gun and so forth, so you wouldn't want a 14-year-old doing this job anyway. All right, let's see. For this particular one, because it's law enforcement, applicant must meet one of the following criteria, there are three, by the entrance of duty date. So by day one of your work. You got a currently holder, have previously held within the last 3 years an NPS specific seasonal level 2 or level 1 law enforcement commission. You got to be pretty fresh for that. Or successful completion of a seasonal law enforcement training program during the last 3 years, but you haven't received your commission yet. Or successfully complete a seasonal law enforcement training program by the entrance on duty date from one of the approved participating academies. So, if this is something that you wanted to do, this is exactly the same kind of requirement for like a wildland firefighting technician. You gotta either have your red card or be able to get your red card by day one of employment. Otherwise, this offer just kind of goes away. Which makes sense. Like, you gotta be trained as a wildland firefighter to be a wildland firefighter with the federal government. So it's normal stuff. Physical efficiency battery. A lot of outdoor-oriented forestry, park ranger, whatever type positions, technician type positions, specialist positions, they have some kind of physical activity requirement. And so it'll say, in general, like what you need to be able to do. You need to, in this case, pass the physical efficiency battery. It's just a fitness test. And not a particularly big deal. But some of the jobs down in the fine print, you want to read through if you're genuinely interested in applying to something, because it's a little bit of work to apply. You want to read through all the fine print and catch things like where they say, must be able to repeatedly lift and carry, irregular loads of up to 50 pounds over open terrain. So that's one that you tend to see specifically listed out in, like, further down in the fine print for wildland firefighter. You got to be able to carry your equipment pack, which might be as much as 50 pounds if it's like a water pack or a tools pack plus your fire shelter plus, you know, respirator and all that stuff. If you can't do that, then you probably are more of a liability than an asset to your wildland firefighting team. So they list that. And you got to be honest with yourself. That's me, or that is definitely not me. Or at least, I can definitely do that if I get hired for this position. I can get into that level of shape by the time I start on day one, if that makes sense. Okay? So, whatever the position is, you really do want to read through these. They're a couple of pages long. total. It doesn't take that long, but you gotta actually go through the whole thing and make sure, yeah, I'm good with all of that. Because they will specifically require you to certify those things. So that's kind of the search side of it. Look for skills and locations that you're interested in. Don't pay any attention to the job title. And for all of the ones that you're interested in, because you're doing the search up to a couple of times a week in the lead up to applying, to find the ones that you want before they close, look for the specific words and phrases that they use to describe things. You're training yourself on, how am I going to describe my past experiences, my skill sets, and so forth in language that they are using? Because if you're not using those keywords and phrases, it's much harder for them to give you credit for everything that you have done. And you have done a lot of stuff. In the beginning of the Federal Resume Guidebook, she says the minimum target for the length on this is 5 to 7 pages. Because the federal government, they're going to look at the number of months and years that you've done at each previously listed position. And then for every single skill that you would bring to this job application, they're going to find the subset of skills that you list that match, hopefully word for word match, if you're doing your reading right here, something in the job listing. And then they multiply that particular one matched skill by the number of months and years that you were at that previously listed position. So if I worked at Touch of Nature and I built trails for 15 months, and I list out all of the specific skills and the tools I've used and so forth, the kinds of trails I've built, using power tools or hand tools or whatever, all of that stuff, for 15 months, each of those skills that I list under that previous experience gets 15 months of credit in the ranking of you versus everybody else. So somebody else who says, well, I worked about a year at Touch of Nature building trails, but they don't list out the specific skills that they use, the specific tools that they used, and the specific number of months that they used or did all this stuff in, they're going to get 12 months of credit instead of 15, and they're not going to get any specific credit under any of those tools, any of those specific trail building skills. All right? So you want to list this stuff out in lots of detail. Each previous job thing that you did for, let's say over the summer, you know, between your freshman and sophomore year here or whatever, expect that to take a page or more. So pretty quickly, this is going to jump right past, you know, whatever resume you use to apply to working at Chongo's or Tres Hombres or something like that, like the 1 or 2 pager, you know. We're going to be super detailed and explicit using the language that's in job listings that you're interested in so that you get specific credit for those things, and you will watch your competitiveness skyrocket past literally everybody else who is applying to this stuff as well, because they don't know to do that. All right? The other thing is to, that she recommends, that's a change from previous times, is to, there's a federal resume builder tool on the site. It's a bunch of forms basically you fill out, and it'll give you the basic structure of it. She says, use that the first time, download that, turn it into a Word document, and then forget completely about the resume builder. It's a disaster. It's a hot mess. You hate to see it. Okay? So there are some bugs in the federal resume building system that will misformat your resume, and you can't necessarily see it, but the people grading your resume, so to speak, ranking it, will see it. And it's super annoying. Like 8-point size text. What is this, a resume for ants? You know, like if you use the format that that builder gives you and then fill it in with your own content and then upload it as like a PDF or Word document, you have full control over how that looks. And you're also playing by their rules or their structure or their template or their format, and you win. Like, you just, your resume is actually readable versus anybody else who trusted the federal government to provide a functional website. All right? Cool. So, take out a blank sheet of paper, and I'll take you through one example section of this. And we'll finish class on this. It's about half past. Got 20 minutes, 19 minutes. All right. So, at the top end of this thing, you're going to have all your contact information, right? Your name, not really your blood type or shoe size, but almost everything else. Address, cell phone number. You want to take a look at the email address that you want to use. Don't use your school email address, because you will lose access to your school email address at most schools after you graduate. Does that make sense? All right. We don't want you to have to fix this later. That's just duplicate work. So, if you are, you know, XXX Dark Lord 42069XXX at gmail.com, don't use that email address either. Best foot forward, right? But use a personal email address that is full and free access to you, that you're not going to lose access to, and so forth. All right, so you know all of your basic contact information, your permanent mailing address, all that stuff. Let's get into the first thing. So, this is a very specific format for what's about to come. Take good notes here. All right. Let's see. We get. You want to list the specific job title. On this example, it's a general clerk 3. So, what is the actual job, legal job title you were hired to in all of your jobs in reverse order, most recent first? Not necessarily the job title that you tell people. So I tell people that I'm a forestry professor. That is not my job title. All right. And then you want to, on that same line, put the year and month that you started and the year and month that you finished that most recent job, or I could say to present if you're still there. In the next line, name the company or agency, or if you're self-employed, you can write that. If you're legally incorporated, you put your company name, your LLC or whatever. So in this case, it's Coastal Development Services. And on that same second line, you'd put the number of hours per week. Okay? So each of these skills, again, it gets multiplied by the number of hours per week that you did it, the number of weeks per month, and the number of months per year times the number of years that you express, okay? We've got a simple little calculator that does all that math for them, and then that gets attached to every skill that you list instead, okay? All right, let's see. The next part that you want to do is a short, like, 1-3 sentence paragraph describing the company. So I'll read you this one. Coastal Development Services is a major human resource organization and defense contractor specializing in personnel management, data oversight, and pay administration. Personnel management, data oversight, and pay administration are going to be three key phrases that appear in the job that you are applying to, if those are true descriptors of that company, put them in because they'll match to what you're applying to. The company has approximately $1 billion in annual revenue and is the largest regional private sector employer. Okay, next up. These are formatted. Each of these next parts is basically one paragraph formatted, and this is the heart and soul of it. This is where you want to put your effort in. In caps, use a 2 or 3 phrase label for a group of skills that you put together for this particular bit of experience. So, pay administration, problem solving, education and training administration, and then a key accomplishments block at the end. So, for me as a professor, I would, instead of pay administration, I don't really work with payroll. but I do a bunch of research design. So I would say instead of pay administration, something like field research design and implementation and communication as that phrase. And then inside of that one paragraph block, go into much more detail with the specific things that I do as a research administrator, okay? So, if you have anywhere from 3 to 5 of these skill groups, plus that header information of general clerk, coastal development services, address, salary, 40 hours per week, and then a key accomplishments paragraph at the back end, each one of these will be about a page or slightly more, okay? To give you a sense of how long these will be. It's not impossible, it's not even unusual for somebody kind of mid-career to have a 20 or 30 page long formatted federal resume, because after 15 or 20 years of working, you have more than a paragraph of skills. And even with like not decades of working yet, maybe, you still have a lot of paragraphs of skill in some real detail. So let's read through just this first paragraph under pay administration. That first cluster of skills. Proactively administer and maintain accuracy for military pay accounts across 3,800 officers and enlisted personnel. Devise, develop, and disseminate information and advice on military customers on pay, electronic service record entries, dependency data guidelines, and benefits/entitlements. So, none of us cares a lot about that. That's like payroll and HR type stuff. But whatever the more specific list of stuff for you, working at Touch of Nature or working at a tree care company over the summer, like, you've got several different skill sets, and each one of those skill sets, a solid paragraph of 3, 4, 5 sentences of detailed specific language, using phrases as much as you can out of the job that you're applying to or the job cluster that you're applying to. So if you're applying to multiple different ones, they're probably going to have some overlap in the keywords that they use, because it's the same federal agencies hiring across these different things. So a biological sciences technician and a wildland firefighter both might have wildland firefighting responsibilities. The keywords are likely, phrases are likely to be the same between those two. So you can cover two different sets of listings with the same set of keywords typically. All right, don't feel like you have to rewrite this for every single job. If we do it right once, you're good to go. All right, so to review, there is contact info type stuff at the top, and then immediately following, you can include or not include the objective, like to work as a park ranger, etc., and then specific job title, month and year to month and year of employment range, next line, name of the company, and how many hours per week. Next line, contact address of the company and salary or wage rate, whichever applies. Next from there, one short paragraph describing the company using key phrases if possible, if they apply. You're not making stuff up. You're not lying. Don't do that. Don't. That's a federal problem. Be honest. But if something that you did in your tree care company transfers to you being a silviculturalist for the Forest Service, use that language. All right. Use those specific key phrases. After that one paragraph description of the company, a 2 or 3 word phrase describing a skill cluster in descriptive terms, and then 3, 4 sentences using a bunch of keywords describing the specific skills inside of that. Okay. Rinse and repeat for different skill sets, anywhere from 3 to 5. If you're at a job for a very long time, you might have as many as 6 or 7 skill sets as the job evolves slightly, but the job title does not. And then last off, you have a key accomplishments paragraph or two. The key accomplishments paragraph has a very specific format as well. Let's take you through that after our several paragraphs of skill sets. And key accomplishments is usually the last part of a specific prior chunk of experience. So I'll read you this one, and then we'll take you through what's actually being said. Key accomplishments. Just like the skill cluster summaries. During a routine audit of transaction data, I identified troubling gaps in the data sets that appear to indicate a problem with system-to-system communication. Sentence one. What's the context? What is a problem that you encountered? What's a difficult operation that you enacted at this job? What's a tricky situation that you improved? That's sentence one. What's the context? What's a problem? Sentence two. Recognizing the seriousness of this issue, I immediately informed my superior and launched an investigation alongside my counterpart at the Department of Defense. Sentence two is, what did you do about the problem? What skills did you apply to solve the problem or prevent the problem or mitigate it, make it less bad? What was your role in it, yours individually? Sentence three. Working in concert, we discovered a database glitch that could be fixed via system update. Sentence three is the solution and how you provided it. How you built the solution, how you discovered the solution, how you finished out your response to the problem and addressed it, closed off the problem. Okay? Sentence four, final sentence. Rinse and repeat for other key accomplishments if you have other stories. My efforts quickly resolved the issue, closed gaps in the data, and ensured accurate pay for 3,800 personnel. I received a commendation for my quick action and problem solving. Sentence four is, what was the resolution? What was the outcome? How did things get better? Were you able to ride off into the sunset atop the beautiful all-white unicorn in your glorious princess gown? What was the outcome? How did it truly get fixed? All right. So sentence one, what's the problem? What's the context? Sentence two, how did you respond? Sentence three, how did you close out the problem? How did you finish it off? Sentence four, what was the outcome? How are things better? Okay. That's a key accomplishment paragraph in a very specific form. If you have a couple other stories that you're real proud of with this particular job, then you have a second key accomplishments paragraph in exactly the same format. What's the problem? How did you respond into the situation?